Hey, it's Damian Barling reminding you to check out the Sacramento Kings podcast right here on the Hoopball Podcast Network for all of your Sacramento Kings news and notes. You can follow me on Twitter at Damian Barling, and you can follow us at Hoopball Kings. Don't miss a single episode of the Sacramento Kings podcast right here on the Hoopball Podcast Network.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
The following is a Hoop Bowl presentation.
Hi guys, it's I, Lyle Swithenbank, back with another installment of the Pelican Scoop. I hope you're all doing well out there. I am for sure. We're settling in to a mere week from the NBA restart. The bubble is set. Today we've got another special guest. We've had one after the other, which has just been fantastic. I've had a chat with a very special man by the name of Todd Spear, the author of Drazen, the remarkable life and legacy of the Mozart of basketball. It's a great book. Make sure you go and get a copy of that, and we'll have a chat to him coming up. Also, we're going to do a review of the first scrimmage of the bubble. So we got to see a bit of Pels action yesterday. They took on the Nets in the bubble, and we're going to have my thoughts on that and what I thought of the whole experience. Overall, spoilers alert, I thought it was good fun. And we will talk about the scores and the like in there, so if you haven't watched it, I'll give you a little spoilers alert before I say what the scores are. But otherwise, so let's get into it. I'd like to introduce Todd Spear, an aficionado on Pistol Pete Maravich as well as Drazen Petrovic. Todd, how are you going?
I'm good, Lyle. Thanks for having me, mate. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, pleasure's all mine, and we're going to talk about a few things today. We're going to talk about your book. We're going to talk about the life and times of the late, great Pete Maravich, Pistol Pete, as a lot of New Orleans fans, I suppose, from the late 70s or early 70s, will remember. And I suppose if you have a look at some of his footage from yesteryear, you'll be equally as impressed as how talented this guy was. Can you tell me a little bit about, firstly, your book, the book about Drazen Petrovic, another guy that was taken, I suppose, a lot sooner than anticipated. There's been a lot of documentaries and the like that have come out of him. I know ESPN did one, I think it was Once Brothers, I think, if I recall correctly.
That's right.
What inspired you to write this book, and how have you found it's been received?
Yeah, well, the book came out in 2016, but it was the process began as early as late 2011. So it was about a three and a half year process to write the book. It had always been a dream of mine to write a book about basketball. It's obviously a passion of mine, but I was always interested in Drazen's story. And, I think any project, starts from interest and Drazen's story was very unique, and I think the more I peeled back layers, I love to research things, and Drazen's story, the further I got into it, the more I realised there was something there. And as you rightly recall, Once Brothers was really one of ESPN's better documentaries, at least that I've seen in the basketball range. And yeah, I think what that exposed, in addition to my book, is that the Drazen story was more about basketball. It was, a story of perseverance, about breaking through barriers, changing perceptions, hard work, which resonates with people, and ultimately a story of tragedy. So, as I said, it was a long process writing the book. What started out as a passion project turned into something more. His family got involved, it's ultimately I self-published. It was then purchased by a publisher. It's been translated into three languages. So to say it's exceeded expectations goes almost without saying. But to have a small piece of Drazen's legacy to be tied into that, means a lot. So, a dream come true to write a book. And very fortunate that it was such a great story. It made my job easy, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I suppose he grew up in a time where Yugoslavia was probably in a bit of turmoil. There was a bit going on over there. And then to be a Croatian basketballer, come over and play in the NBA. And, there was all these question marks as to how his career would have developed and what if. He's taken at 28.
Correct.
Taken at 28, wasn't he? He was quite young. And that was a tragic car accident, if my memory serves me right. And phenomenal that you've put this together, and to have the family involved, that's a testament to itself, and it shows that your hard work and I think the way it's been received from all reports is phenomenal. You were saying off air that it's been translated into Croatian, which is his native language. I mean, geez, that's awesome.
Well, I was fortunate enough, the Petrovic family coordinated an event when that Croatian translation launched. It's been 3 years now. So to be there, to go to Zagreb, where Drazen once lived, to spend time with his family, talk about surreal. But to have, it was almost a little bit of pressure, knowing that you're something that you had worked so hard on was now being evaluated by the people who knew him best. But I suppose the greatest compliment I've received with the book was that Drazen's only brother told me that he learnt things about Drazen by reading my book. So I don't think, I probably should have retired right then and there and quit. And, because that's probably as good a compliment as you can get. So that it's available in Croatian and will be forever is just awesome.
Absolutely. I'm in awe. I reckon that is just to be able to put something together like that, and then to have the, the acknowledgement and appreciation from the family as well. I mean, you're part of his legacy now. You're intertwined. So, that in itself is phenomenal, and I applaud you for that. And I've, like I said off air, I've got one on order. And if anyone out there is listening, go and get a copy of this book by Todd Spears. Make sure you go and get that. And where can we grab that one from?
Amazon is probably the best bet as far as quickest delivery. It also offers the digital version, the Kindle version. So I would recommend going to Amazon.
Awesome. So get that one. It's The Mozart of Basketball, Drazen Petrovic by Todd Spear. If you need something to read, I know we're all looking for a hoops fix. So get out there and get a copy of that. And no doubt I'll be having a read and be talking about it on here in future episodes, no doubt. So what we've all been waiting for, and I have it on good authority that Todd is the guru on Pistol Pete Maravich. So I might have put him on the spot here with that with that build up, but
for sure,
Todd, I'd love to talk about him. He's almost a part of folklore in New Orleans as part of the New Orleans Jazz and Louisiana State as well. From what I understand, he was one of the greatest college basketballers of nearly all time, if not all time. And can you tell me a little bit about Pistol Pete and what drew you to him?
Yeah, well, we all have things we're passionate about. We can only speak from our perspective, but Pete is to say that he's an inspiration even today is an understatement. I spend time thinking about Pete every day, in fact, and research his life. It's almost an endless pursuit for me. He was an inspiration growing up, of course. as a kid, you're attracted to things that capture your imagination. And I was not even aware of Pete while he was alive. I was only 4 years old and on the other side of the world, but became aware of him mostly through a home video called Showman, Spectacular Guards of the NBA, which was released by NBA Entertainment in 1990. I never saw a copy until, I think, 1993 or 94, and was just completely captivated by a 4 minute segment on his career. You know, black and white footage, grainy footage of moves by a player that seemed out of his generation almost. So from that moment on, I read everything on Pete. As I said, I research his life endlessly, pursue footage, pursue audio, anything that can, you know, peel back a little bit of more information about what he achieved. But as you mentioned, his college career is probably what he is best known for. He's the all-time leading scorer in the history of the NCAA, 3,667 points. You know, obviously without the benefit of a three-point line, only played 3 years because freshmen weren't eligible in 66-67 when he got his start. But he went to the NBA, but his best years came when he was a member of the New Orleans Jazz. So once again, back in Louisiana where he was a college hero. That's where he made his home after he retired from the game. And he was a resident of Louisiana when he passed away at the age of 40. But just a huge inspiration to me. You know, I can trace my lineage. I was fortunate enough to play college basketball in America. And I can, hand on heart, honestly say that the reason for that was I watched his instructional tapes. I heard about, you know, learned about his story through a movie that was made about his childhood. Dedicating your life to something was pretty cool to a young kid. So to see that Pete had dedicated his life to basketball was just completely captivating to someone like me. And I've effectively done the same, albeit with far less results, but Pete's passion for basketball just resonates so much every single day of my life. So I owe a lot to him. And it's such a special story, but also, you know, a story that's a little bit heartbreaking at times as well. But just a wonderful legacy to the game. Yeah, any game you watch today, you see a little bit of Pete. So very, very special.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he got the Pistol Pete moniker because of his shooting style, wasn't he? Shot from his hip instead of further out. And I think I saw a stat today. I was doing a bit of digging and saw that someone had worked out how much he would have actually scored had there been a three-point line, and it was astronomical. I think it was over nearly 4,000 points or something like that, or more, and averaged nearly 57 points a game or something like that.
Well, the nickname... You are correct. The nickname did come from sort of a shooting style. As a high school player, he was very almost underdeveloped physically when he first played as an eighth grader at Daniel High School. And the ball would come from his hip up through sort of his rib cage, and it was like a gunfighter, you know, drawing his pistol. So that's where the nickname came from. And you're right about the statistic. Was Dale Brown, who was the longtime coach at LSU, even coached Shaq there. He apparently went through the play-by-play data from all the games that Maravich played at LSU and based on the distance recorded from the shots, was able to determine how many additional points he would have averaged with a three-point line. But just a couple of weeks ago, I was going through some footage. There's a game against Loyola, which was based in Louisiana. And they actually played on the they played a game against LSU December 2nd of 68, and it was played on the same floor that the Buccaneers, the ABA team, played. So there was a three-point line there. Now, the film's not complete, but in the first 6 minutes of the game, Pete made three set shots from behind that three-point line, and it was rather effortless. So to imagine what his numbers would be like with a three-point line, certainly would have exceeded 50 points a game, but it would be nice to know just exactly how many points that was.
Absolutely, and I bet it would have wowed some people back then if they were sitting there watching it, watching a guy launch threes like that. They'd be thinking it was 2020 with the amount of threes he'd be launching. But
absolutely,
phenomenal talent, no doubt. I mean, he joined a struggling, well, an expansion team in the New Orleans Jazz. They didn't start so well, though. I know the New Orleans Jazz went and mortgaged the future, basically, as we were talking about off air, to go and get him. Do you think that was because of the, I suppose, affection of this man being so, linked with Louisiana?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Jazz were, I think the maneuver to get Pete, you know, which they gave up 2 firsts, 2 seconds, two picks in the expansion draft. Like they gave up a lot to get one player, and the deal was called the Louisiana Purchase by the media. Like, it was just this such an exaggerated deal, especially by a team that had no assets. So Pete was technically their first player. And decisions were made by people in the Jazz organization that were not basketball people. So, like, they the application for a franchise came in February. It was approved in March. Within days, they were contacting the Hawks to try to land Maravich, and it was a credibility move, sort of a quick fix with the fan base. It took a huge chunk out of their foundation in a player sense. But obviously they had one of the best guards in the game. I think Pete finished second in the league in scoring in 73-74. And so they did. That credibility was there. But beyond Pete, there was very, very little.
If you have a look at his time in the New Orleans Jazz, he averaged, that first year he came in, 21 points, 5 rebounds, 6.2 assists, they're saying. This guy, he could obviously play, and that just got better. I mean, 76, 77, they reckon he averaged 31 points or something like that. Looked like he was carrying them, to say the least. So when Pistol Pete, we'll back up a little bit. When Pistol Pete came into the league, it was with the Atlanta Hawks, from what I understand. Was he a star from day one? Was coming out of LSU, obviously he was the leader in points. Was he received like that straight away?
Pete had a very celebrated college career, as we've touched on, and he was the subject of a bidding war between, obviously, the Atlanta Hawks, the Carolina Cougars of the ABA, and even the Globetrotters. So, yes, he was a star, but beyond that, in an era where capitalizing on, making money, he was seen as a draw card. So, a big reason that the Hawks were able to obtain him was from a trade with the Warriors the previous year, where they had obtained the number 3 pick. But a big motivating factor behind them obtaining him was to effectively proceed with getting the Omni belt, which the Hawks played there through to the, the 97 season. So getting financial backing to build a new arena was a big motivating factor in the Hawks getting him. The Hawks were a successful team. They'd been a playoff team in 1970 and had success with a mostly black roster of players. So Pete coming in, you had guys like Joe Caldwell, who was a very, very fine professional player, Lou Hudson, guys who were deserving of more money than they were on. And then you get Pete coming in, who gets, $2 million to effectively, without playing a game, in addition to endorsements, probably at a time when endorsements were not a real big player for individual or players in a team sport. So Maravich came with a lot of hoopla. The time in Atlanta was difficult. They didn't win much. Yes, they made the playoffs in 3 out of 4 years, but they didn't win enough to sort of justify getting him. He was always the subject of intense scrutiny. He developed, mononucleosis before his second season. He had Bell's palsy on 2 different occasions, even during the 1973 season, which was one of his best as a professional. So you could see that the anxiety and stress was taking a personal toll. And by 1974, he was effectively available for trade. And, you know, Pat Williams, who was the GM of the Hawks at the time, has been on record as saying there was, you know, very little interest. So I think his reputation, his salary, you know, he had never been in a situation where his teams had been successful, and not necessarily his fault. So there was a real dichotomy there with Maravich. There was a faction of the basketball community that we just thought he was unbelievable, a great talent. And then there was another that that really thought he was overrated, selfish, you know, driven by the need to be a showman as opposed to playing with substance. So there was a real divided opinion on, by the time he got to the Jazz, on whether or not he was actually worth his weight in gold. So to go to an expansion team is really like resetting, and there was no possibility to win. So that it reinforced really that stigma that he was an individual.
Yeah, and when he then got traded over to the Jazz, you know, like we talked about, there was, I suppose, they mortgaged the future a bit to get him. The team around him, because of this, I suppose, on-flow effect that they just didn't have assets to be able to get good players, he was then in sort of a lower-ranked team than at Atlanta, and these guys struggled a fair bit. Was he the, I suppose, I know he's the draw card, but was it the Pete Maravich show, I guess, down there? Is that what everyone would come to say, and the rest was just part and parcel?
Yeah, there's no doubt. And one of the reasons that the league granted a franchise was a nine-man group that effectively took over the Jazz is because the Superdome was being built. And the expectation was that if you could marry together professional basketball with, you know, one of the first domes that would house professional basketball, would drive attendance. It would, you know, almost be a surefire moneymaker. But a big problem with the Jazz at that time was they were being ran by non-basketball people. So the ownership had very little background in basketball. The general manager at the time had a marketing background. They were putting people in places where they shouldn't have been, and what resulted was, yeah, really a poor cast of players alongside Pete. And yeah, like I said before, it reinforced that notion that it really didn't matter how the Jazz did. What really mattered was how many Pete, how many points Pete got. The thrilling the fans, being in New Orleans and being the favourite son. But the basketball decisions that were made were really off kilter, and as a result, the team was never truly successful in the 5 years it spent in New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, those 5 years, the glorious years, and, you know, they're still thought of fondly, I guess, by the New Orleans faithful, and everyone knows the name Pistol Pete Maravich, but besides that, I suppose, you know, I can't dig out any more names off the top of my head besides him. When it was... did we get to the point where it was so financially, I suppose, difficult to keep going that there was that force to Utah for that move?
Yeah, so one of the factors in the move, which came in April of 79, was the fact that New Orleans was home to the Mardi Gras each year. So, you know, if you go back and look at the Jazz schedule in December and January of every year, they would leave New Orleans. I think, and I'm going from memory here, I don't think Pete played a game in New Orleans in the month of December in each of his first 2 years in New Orleans, because the team was just gone for that period of time. One of the reasons they got off to the, I think it was 3-34 start in 74-75 is because they played in two homes. The municipal auditorium was housing the Mardi Gras, and their other Loyola Fieldhouse was their other home base during that first year. They couldn't get dates in there, so you know they were on the road for a large portion of the first half of the year. They got off to a shocking start, and that problem sort of plagued the team The team owed a lot of money to the Superdome by the time 1979 came around. I believe in 1978 they still owed the team owed the Superdome money from the 75-76 season. So they were 3 years, you know, in arrears financially. Pete got hurt during the 77-78 season, and a possibility of making the playoffs was gone. So all these factors mixed in together, it could have been successful if it was managed by the right people, but it just wasn't.
And then you see these what ifs. You know, he went off and played in Utah, and then to Boston, I believe, and then it was that was all, wasn't it? And then by 1980, he was retired. And am I correct in saying that? That was the show's over, and all of a sudden the showman had hung up the boots.
Yeah, that's right. At the age of 33, so I mean, there were good years in New Orleans. He led the league in scoring, as you mentioned, in 76-77, and he was leading the league in scoring in 78. He got hurt January 31, 1978 versus Buffalo, and you know, we talk about the showmanship and the importance to the fan base. Well, you know, he was in the game, a blowout win, and you know, tried to, you know, throw a pass 3/4 of the length of the floor between his legs, and of course landed awkwardly. His knee was never the same. After that, he played a little bit in the 79 season. Attendance took a nosedive. You know, the team relocates to Utah. Basically, there's new management in Utah, and they make the decision that, you know, he's not part of their future. Gets traded, you know, well, he gets waived, I beg your pardon, and signs with Boston. Had a decision between Boston and Philadelphia, and decided with Boston. Philadelphia ended up making the finals that year, and then he retires in 1980, and Boston wins the title the next season. So he couldn't catch a break, unfortunately, Pete, and retired at 33. And, you know, nowadays there are still players who are very, very productive at that age, and you'd like to think with modern medicine and a couple of breaks here and there that Pete could have become this grand old man of basketball, but he just didn't happen for him. And he was gone after 10 years in the NBA, just 10, and really only played, if you add up the games he played, he probably only played maybe 7 or 8 years in total. So we only had him a very short time.
And it's such a shame when you see talents like this and transcendent talents where you still hear about them today. Like if you hear that name, you go, oh, yep, no, I know who that guy is. And
yep.
I don't think there's many guys like that, even in today's, maybe a handful of guys that I suppose transcend generations. I hadn't realised until I started talking to you and learning about it, you didn't really play for that long in comparison. You know, 33, they're saying that's sort of the end of your prime thereabouts. You still got probably another 3 or 4 years in today's league, minimum. And I mean, after that, he retired, and then, so you said he retired at 33, and then by 40 he'd passed away. And that was another shocking, I suppose, surprise thing. That how did that play out? That was unexpected, wasn't it?
Well, it was sort of, you know, Pete spent, evidently spent his life searching for a meaning. You know, he went through various phases of, you know, trying to find purpose for why he was alive. And, you know, I think something to rescue him from his personal issues. His mother committed suicide in October of 74. He went through, you know, bouts with alcoholism during his playing career. By the time he retired, he, you know, really felt an emptiness. He became a born-again Christian in November of 82. And what came with that was a new meaning, a new purpose for living. And so he spent his last years alive speaking about his faith. In a very public way, he became a speaker. He was doing a lot of basketball clinics. He was slowly re-emerging on the NBA scene. He would appear at the Legends game every year, and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1987. But unfortunately, he passed away on January 5, 1988. He was missing a coronary artery. So, you know, everyone has two, and he only had one, and it went undiagnosed. So he died suddenly at the age of 40, and, left behind two sons. And, very, very tragic thing. And what a wonderful thing it would be if he was still alive and could, you know, obviously share his wisdom and his memories and probably would have contributed something, contributed more to the game of basketball. So a career cut short and unfortunately a life cut short as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a shame to hear things like that. You know, when you lose guys like that, there's this knowledge and there's this wealth of, I suppose, talent and knowledge and mentoring that could, you just say, what if? It's a big question mark. Yeah. And to see what this guy did during his career, to that not him not to be sitting courtside, you know, with the, like Bill Russells and guys like that, that's sitting there with all the rings and talking about basketball from generations gone by. Oh, it's devastating. And you just, you never know what would have happened there. You're 40, you've got a lot of life to live, and to have one coronary artery, I mean, that's unbelievable that he lived as long as he did, really. They're pretty essential arteries to have.
Well, autopsies and things that came out afterwards, studies about his, about his health. Apparently, you know, most people who have that condition die in their teens. But from what I understand, the existing artery that he did have, coronary artery, was actually larger and had compensated by wrapping itself around his heart and in a way made his heart, I guess, stronger on an interim basis. But as I said, it was undiagnosed. But, you know, you made a great point about the wealth of knowledge that we've lost out on. You're right, he should be that person that, because of his contribution, you know, stylistically to the game of basketball, he should be still here, and he should be, you know, you should see him at the All-Star weekend, and, you know, you should see him contributing in some way, somewhere, with all that he had to offer. And it's obviously very, very sad that he was not able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. If we rewind, and I mean, I want to talk about his most famous for is his LSU career. I know I've jumped all around, but I thought I would leave that to last because that's what I suppose he was most famous for. I mean, he was coached by his dad, I think, for a while, and he absolutely dominated this LSU career. Can you talk about that a little bit? The career that he had at LSU, like you said, his freshman, he didn't play. He couldn't play in the actual senior team. It was just the juniors, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So you're correct. He did play for his father, Press, who was a great college coach. He'd won an ACC title at Clemson. And Pete played high school basketball in Raleigh, North Carolina. But he did a year of military school before he went to LSU. And obviously only went there because of his father. I believe Pete's intention was to go to West Virginia and follow in the footsteps of Jerry West. But when his father was at LSU and promised to buy him a car, he made the decision to go to LSU. And, you know, it's an interesting period of time. Yes, you know, Pete set records, records that are likely never to be touched. But I think what happened there was it was the birth of the expectation that Pete play a certain way. You know, his father was a brilliant coach. And he'd really built Pete almost to be what he perceived the perfect basketball player. So he had him do, you know, an endless array of drills and built his skill level up really to a level that's perhaps unmatched even today. But what came with that was the expectation and the demand from the public that the showmanship be sort of the everlasting part of his game. And I think what got compromised, and even what got compromised from his father, was everything else went out the window. I mentioned, you know, Press Maravich's success prior to LSU. Well, he felt that LSU could only win if Pete took a majority of the shots. And what resulted was, you know, a record-setting college career, but LSU did not have much success in the SEC. They never made the NCAA tournament. And even Press compromised his coaching style in order to accentuate the things that Pete did better than anyone before or since, and that was the shooting, the dribbling, the passing. He really accentuated all those elements of his game. And yes, you know, an unbelievable college career, but you would like to think that perhaps in a better setting, a more, you know, a better functioning setting, that, you know, he could have even be even better, averaging 25 to 30 points, averaging 8 to 10 assists around better players, and, you know, there would have been greater team success.
Yeah, and I think we're all judged by that at the end, and we always judge the legends of their success, and it's such a shame that he just never really got across the line there, and I think it was purely because he was such a, I guess, icon, is that it was difficult to be standing in the same light as him on the court. So, yeah. I mean, I really appreciate what you've shed some light on Pistol Pete. I mean, yeah, again, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have anything to plug while I've got you? Is there anything coming up that we can look forward to, which we can get people out there and having a look at? What's happening?
Yeah, I've been working for the past 18 months on an encyclopedia of the NBA finals. So I've got probably another 12 months of research, but yeah, it's going to be a big book, sort of a compendium with lots of new information there. So I'm really excited about it. So, but yeah, I need to work on my patience because I want to get to the finish line, but yeah, there's a lot of work to be done in the meantime, but working on that at the moment and really excited about it.
That sounds awesome. Well, sign me up for a copy. That'll be awesome. I'll be looking forward to sinking my teeth into that. Todd, I honestly, again, I appreciate your time, taking the time to speak with me and for our listeners at the Pelican Scoop at Hoopball. Thanks once again, and I appreciate all that you've done. And guys, if you're listening out there, go and buy a copy of Todd's book. Go and get it, read it, tweet us, let us know what you think. I reckon it's going to be awesome. I'm looking forward. If we didn't have this COVID, I'm sure it would already have arrived, but we're waiting for that because of postal issues. But but Todd, yeah, thanks very much, and hopefully we can speak soon.
I appreciate having me on, Lyle, to talk about Pete, and yeah, and also the kind words, mate, so thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. We'll no doubt we'll be hearing more soon about Pete, and we look forward to catching up soon.
Thanks, mate. All the best.
So how good was that? Great chat with Todd Spear. That was a couple of weeks ago now that we jumped on and chatted Pistol Pete. Absolute wealth of knowledge, and really appreciate his time as always. Guys, as I said beforehand, run out and grab Todd Spear's book, Drazen Petrovic, The Life and Legacy of the Mozart of Basketball. You can get that on Amazon, as he said. Yeah, fantastic book, and we're looking forward to his compendium coming out about the NBA Finals. Now, guys, what we're going to have a chat about is the first Pels scrimmage. Awesome. NBA TV had it on. Pelicans.com was also streaming it. So the bounce down or tip-off was yesterday, being the 23rd of July. We took on the Brooklyn Nets. First thoughts of the venue. So it's set up similar to the basketball tournament, if you were following along with that and the videos they had there. The stadium is socially distanced, but they had a whole heap of graphics. It was a Brooklyn home game, so there was the Brooklyn graphics all over the back wall. They had this stadium announcer in there announcing anytime someone made a shot, which was, I thought, a nice touch. It added to the authenticity. As soon as the commentary came in over the top, it was a lot more like normal basketball, and you could get back into it. There was a few technical errors on the stream I was watching for a while, but otherwise it was all good. It was good fun. We started off the first quarter quickly. I thought we came out really fast. The Brooklyn Nets
were missing a whole heap of players, as we knew coming into this. So it wasn't a surprise that we gave them the jump. Jackson Hayes, I thought, as a young bloke, started really well. He seemed to have used that off-season to really work on his defensive positioning. I thought that was important. He caused a lot of disruptions throughout the Nets' offense, which I thought was perfect. Lonzo started off a little bit quickly and rushed a pass at one point, but then all of a sudden it turned into in and out, and he hit a big three. So have no issues with that. The guys, these scrimmages are there to get the rust out. There's a few lapses on the perimeter, which we talked about early in the season, and again, it's all rust factor. No, you know, we're looking at this to get these guys right so that when they get back in to play these eight games coming up, they're going to be in shape, they're going to be ready to go, and the chemistry will have reignited. So we're excited to see that. They had a few open threes, and they had a point guard on the Nets who was lighting us up, Chioza. He looks good. So, I mean, if we're looking for a backup point guard and he's a free agent, he might be someone to have a look as a third or fourth string point guard. But anyway, that's just my opinion. JJ Redick had some good hustle movements in the first quarter. Not bad for the old bloke who was diving on everything. Another on-floor presence. Josh Hart, he did miss one three, and it was just taking a bit of time to get his legs under him. And that, again, it's all this rust. You know, we can't take too much from the scrimmages purely because, you know, they're just trying things out. And that was, I suppose, accentuated by the four-guard lineup that we ran for a while. So there was a cycling of Drew, Lonzo, Nikhil, JJ Redick, Josh Hart, and Etuan Moore. So at points, we had all four of them on, and then Jackson Hayes. And it was interesting to see that we were going that four small. But again, it seemed to work. Spoiler alert, by the end of the first quarter, 23-14 in favor of New Orleans. The Nets just, they were blowing it. They had 14 points on 18 shots. They were not looking good, and everything we knew about Caris LeVert being a bit of a trigger happy, it was, I suppose, accentuated by the fact there was no one else. So he took a lot of shots, and he missed a lot of shots, unfortunately. Heading into the second quarter, we stayed with the four-guard lineup, which I didn't mind. It was good to get a bit of continuity. Etuan Moore started really well. There was a lot of good movement of the ball, and then Etuan Moore splashed a couple of big threes. Lonzo hit a three. It was good to see that the confidence was there to light it up from distance and to make them. Lonzo's three-point shot continues to improve, and I think if that is something that he maintains, we're in very good stead going forward, because that spacing from your point guard is so important. Hart took it to the rack. He slithered in and laid it in, which was nice. Etuan Moore, big steal to a Hart driving kick. Hit a fading JJ Redick. That was one of his signature shots in the second quarter. He was fading sideways and hit a massive three. Then we went back to our old ways and didn't secure the defensive rebound at the end of the possession. It was very frustrating to see, because the guys know what they're doing, but again, maybe that's the four-guard lineup. We were too short, but what can you do? We didn't see much of B.I. in this quarter. We only saw him mostly in the first quarter for the whole game. But I think we understood that a few of these bench guys were going to get a bit of a run. And they were trying a few different things out, especially with no Zion Williamson, who, if you hadn't heard, he is not in the bubble at the moment. He's at home for a family emergency, so hopefully he's all good there. Favors also wasn't playing, I think just for management purposes. But in the end of the second quarter, we were up 56-35. So we head into the third quarter. Drew looking strong defensively on the perimeter, going to the rack as well. We mucked around for a bit. There was a bit of confusion, 24-second shot clock violation, which you don't like to see. Someone's got to put it up. You've got to be aware of where you are on the court and how much time you've got. Jackson Hayes jumped up, offensive interference. I don't mind that. It was a jump probably a little bit too early, but otherwise, keep crashing the glass. If you're up there, mate, and you've got the athleticism, go up there and dunk it in. You're going to get them more often than you're not. A guy that surprised me was Jahlil Okafor. He came in and just went to work in the post. It was old school. It was flashes of Al Jefferson almost. Up and unders. He did a little post hook. He also did a drop step and then into a jam. Yeah, I was big fan of Jar in this quarter. He looked great. Kendrick Williams had come in for his first few minutes. He drove in, dumped it off to Jar, another big dunk. Kenny Hustle, as his moniker goes, was diving. He dove out of bounds. He drew a foul, big charge, which he drew. And then Okafor, out on the perimeter, locked up Jared Allen, which, again, phenomenal to see. We had the bench on for this quarter. I mean, we started running away with it. Moore, Jar, Frank Jackson, Noor, and Kenny Hustle were the five. Not mad about it. They look really good. And if our bench can play that well against every team, we're going to be held in good stead. New Orleans, spoiler alert, at the end of the third quarter, 71-54. Heading into the fourth quarter, Etuan Moore was still in. He had a good reverse layup, which we liked. Kenny Hustle, he drew another foul. He is really good at drawing charges. He gets set. Awesome. And if you can keep that going, that makes you an important part of your rotation because you can put a guy in there and he disrupts. And a disruptor is important. So we're glad we've got him on the team and hopefully he can keep that effort up. You can't teach attitude and hustle. So that's pretty good. Frank Jackson threw it down. We were happy with that. He took on Jared Allen at a different point as well. Went straight at him. I don't mind that. Good on him. Go and get it. Happy with that. Finishing off in the fourth quarter, Jackson Hayes pulled the chair out on Allen at one point. That was good patience. He didn't foul. He just let it happen. Frank Jackson earned the moniker Baby Fro from the commentators. That was quite hilarious when he was walking along next to Jared Allen, and it looked like a smaller version of Jared Allen. So it was very funny, the haircuts, and you can see that they're all due for the barber, and I think that's getting built in the bubble at the moment, so no doubt a few of the guys will be getting in there and getting a cut soon enough. The bench points at this point of about the 4 minute mark left of the fourth, bench points 38-22, which is just phenomenal that we've got those guys doing that. The ball movement was good from the bench. Nikhil, he went in for the layup. He did that well. Frank, big three. We got to see a bit of Sindaris Thornwell as well. And he caused a steal straight away, which is phenomenal. We're happy with that. He again, locked a few guys up. Really good. Another guy that again, I'm going to mention is Jahlil Okafor. He hit him with the shake and bake in the post. Little baby hook. That was awesome. Pick and roll slam. We also got to see Zylan Cheatham. He came in. He wanted a lob immediately, and that shows his likelihood of... he must have some sort of athleticism if he's calling for that. Fortunately, it was broken up, but otherwise, they did really, really well. Jar up and under again. He was killing him in the post. Unfortunately, at the end, it looked like they were onto him, and he had a turnover. He got a little bit too keen, and the ball slipped out of his hands. A little bit of Nikhil playing the point in the last minute or so, which I don't mind. I think that's good to have those guard skills developed early. Spoiler, the final score of the game, 99-68 in favor of New Orleans. So we gave them a touch up. We're really happy with that. The next scrimmage comes up in a couple of days. Again, NewOrleans.com is streaming them, I think, as well. NBA TV will have them on there. So make sure you go and have a look at that if you're missing your New Orleans Pelicans stuff and your team. And, you know, we love the Pelicans here. So for us, any Pelicans basketball is good Pelicans basketball. As always, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. This is a hoop-ball.com presentation. There's heaps going on over at Hoopball. We're all firing back up. All the shows are going. So if you're looking for your team, we've got a whole heap of team coverage. We've got daily fantasy shows. We've got season-long shows. We've also got the partnership with Manscaped.com. Manscaped.com. If you use the code at checkout, HoopBall20, so HoopBall20 at checkout, you'll get free shipping and also 20% off your offer. So make sure you go and have a look over there for all your grooming products. I've got powders and oils and all other things, boxer shorts, whatever you want. The Lawnmower 3.0 with its built-in LED light. Guys, make sure you go over and support us and support Manscaped because, we'll keep this rolling and hopefully you guys enjoy it. So I think for now, we've just ticked over the 50-minute mark of the podcast, and you've probably heard enough of me rattling on for today. So guys, I will leave you with this. Stay safe out there. Enjoy basketball. We're a week away. Until next time, I'm Lyle Swithenbank. This is the Pelican Scoop, a hoop-ball.com presentation. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.
This has been a Hoop Ball presentation.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.